Before the Trump administration, there was a man who paved the way for such behavior in Washington. Nearly 5 decades ago, a scandal goes overlooked in the White House. In the midst of Richard Nixon's Watergate investigation, there was a separate investigation going on with the vice president as well. Thank you for listening to the Chronicles of Time. This is Rachel Payton. Let's dive into Spiro Agnew. Born in 1918 in Baltimore, Maryland, Spiro Theodore Agnew was the son of a Greek immigrant father and a Virginia-born mother. During Spiro's childhood, the Agnew family was flourishing with their family restaurant, the Piccadilly. The restaurant was hit hard and forced to close its doors during the crash of 1929. This led to the family to move into a small apartment. Spiro was what he called a typical middle-class youth. He would graduate Forest Park High School in 1937, and that same year he would attend Johns Hopkins University. He would study chemistry there. It only took him 2 years to figure out he wasn't a chemistry man. But oh, how we all wish he would have been. It would have saved the country some turmoil. With chemistry behind him, Agnew decided to pursue law. He transferred to the University of Baltimore School of Law in 1939. To keep himself afloat during law school, he took night classes and worked as an insurance clerk through the day. Spiro would spend 3 years at this job, where he would meet his future wife and filing clerk, Eleanor Judefind, or better known as Judy. They turned out to be quite the pair and had unusual circumstances for their wedding day. With Agnew drafted for World War II, he and Judy married just days after he graduated from Army Officer Candidate School. With the short 2-day honeymoon, Agnew had to go where he was needed, and that was to serve the country. Once the war ended, Agnew was discharged and returned to studying law. Back home in Baltimore, Agnew secured a job as a law clerk with the firm Smith & Barrett. Up until this point, Spiro was not very interested in politics. He was a Democrat at the time because that is what his father had been his whole life. This is where things started going in a different direction for Agnew. Lester Barrett, his boss, would explain to him that shall he want a career in politics, he needs to be a Republican. Baltimore was full of Democrats and needed a strong Republican figure to revamp the party. In 1947, Agnew would register himself as a Republican, taking the advice of his employer. That same year, he would go on to pass the bar exam in the state of Maryland. Many years would pass before Agnew would decide to run for office. In 1956, he ran for Baltimore County Council as a Republican candidate. It was an unsuccessful run for office, but this did bring forth opportunities in the field of politics. He was appointed to the Zoning Board of Appeals in his efforts to achieve county council. Another unsuccessful run for County Circuit Court in 1960 would allow him to get his feet in the water. Even though he lost, his persistence caught the eyes of many. He would go on to lose one more election in 1962 when running in the United States congressional race. At this point, you've got to be thinking, or at least I am, how did this man become our vice president in the same decade that he has lost 2 runs for office? At last, Spiro Agnew would have a successful campaign. He would serve as county executive, the first Republican to do so since 1895. Agnew held this position for 1 term, declining to run for a second. What is he going to do now? He decided to run for the governor of Maryland. I am not going to beat around the bush. Maryland had some major bigots running for governor in the year of 1966. On one side, we had George Mahoney, an open opponent of integrated housing. On the other side, we had Spiro Agnew, the seemingly pro-civil rights with moderate views. Let's put a giant emphasis on seemingly. By George Mahoney taking his stance on integrated housing, Agnew secured 70% of the African-American vote, securing the election. The perception of progressiveness that Agnew had placed in people's mind would be short-lived. As the civil rights movement grew more intense, Agnew pushed back and put blame on African-Americans. Following the death of Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968, riots broke out around the nation. Agnew declared a state of emergency in Baltimore due to the city being up in flames for 3 days. The National Guard came to restore order after chaos had erupted. More than 1,200 fires have been tamed, over 4,000 placed under arrest, and 6 people left dead during the incidents. On April 11th, Agnew asked 100 prominent African-American leaders to meet with him at the state capitol. Instead of calling for peace and having reasonable discussion, Agnew attacked and cast blame at them. The event was televised, and more than half of the invited guests walked out in disgust. Letters from angry citizens protesting the disrespect from Agnew was enormously outnumbered by the amount of support he was receiving. One of his fans was Pat Buchanan. Buchanan was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon. He was so impressed by Agnew's speech that he showed Nixon himself. Nixon was mesmerized by the toughness Agnew showed. He immediately saw an asset in Agnew. During the presidential campaign of 1968, Spiro Agnew was originally a supporter of the governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller would drop out of the race, eventually leading Agnew to be swayed to another candidate. When it came to Richard Nixon, Agnew had admitted that he may be his second choice. The pair met for the first time on March 29th at Richard Nixon's New York apartment. The two met for almost 2 hours. It's safe to say that the pair hit it off, so much so that Nixon had decided to declare Agnew his running mate in the election. On August 8th, the last day of the Republican National Committee in Miami Beach, Nixon told the world who he had chosen for his vice president. It was time to campaign for Nixon and Agnew. With little recognition, people were curious as to who or what Spiro Agnew was. There were bigger names being thrown around for the possible running mate, including Ronald Reagan, the governor of California. But what was it about Agnew that led him to be the chief's go-to man? Agnew was outspoken, abrupt, and persuasive. He could capture a crowd with his demanding presence. This played a key factor in Nixon's decision to make him vice president. Richard Nixon needed to secure the southern states, but he had one problem: a man named George Wallace. Wallace was the governor of Alabama and also one hell of a racist. Wallace was a supporter of segregation and most famously quoting, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever." Nixon needed an outspoken man to rally votes in the South in order to secure his win over Wallace. The only other challenger that posted a threat was Hubert Humphrey, the former vice president to Lyndon B. Johnson. President Johnson had been seeing a rapid decrease in approval ratings, therefore putting doubts into people's mind about Humphrey. Would he become a Johnson 2.0? This apprehension led Richard Nixon to win the election of 1968. The first term was glorious for the Nixon-Agnew administration, so it was no surprise when they won again. They didn't just win, they won big. It was the largest presidential victory in history. Nixon won over 60% of the popular vote in 49 states, every single state but Massachusetts. This tremendous start to the second term would be short-lived. Soon, both the President of the United States and the Vice President would be under investigation, at the same time, for different crimes. The 70s truly were a different time. Richard Nixon and Watergate would soon be all anyone could talk about. Did the President know or set up the break-in of the Democratic National Committee? While that may be the thoughts on the nation's mind, three young prosecutors in Maryland had other things to worry about. Is the Vice President also possibly corrupt? George Ball, the United States Attorney for the state of Maryland, was working with a team of IRS agents and had found enough red flags by public officials to start an all-out investigation. He sent his three assistants to work. Tim Baker and Barney Skolnick were both Harvard graduates, and Ron Liebman had worked under a criminal defense lawyer. Having seen how things operated on the opposite side, Ron had insight and understanding that was valuable to the team. Skolnick had already sent political figures to prison, and Baker worked under a chief justice. The three men would be unstoppable. What they would come to discover would be shocking. Maryland in the 1970s was polluted in corruption. It was common knowledge that in order to do business with the local government, you had to pay. Former senators, congressmen, county executives, Speaker of the House, governors, and state attorneys had all been caught for illegal activities. What the prosecutors were trying to find out was who all was guilty of illegal activity. With Spiro Agnew long gone from his county executive job, his name was not being entertained. Just yet. The investigation started in December 1973 in Baltimore County. Subpoenas were issued to the 19 largest contractors and also to county records. It was only 2 weeks after the subpoenas were distributed when a local architect was ready to talk. He was said to have been paying 5% of his contract to Baltimore County government to obtain projects. Ironically enough, one project was the Baltimore County Courthouse. So how exactly was the money falling into the hands of the officials? In this case, the architect would issue bonuses to executives of the company, then they would keep enough of the money to cover income tax on it and give it back to the company. Once the money was accounted for and back with the company, it would now be delivered to that county official. According to the architect, the practice had started once Agnew left office. After hearing about the paybacks from the architect, the prosecution focused on one company in particular. Wanting to talk to five top executives from the company, they were granted immunity. They needed to know what the men had to say. This was absolutely crucial to the investigation. All five of them verified what was previously said by the architect. Since immunity was granted for the executives, the prosecutors decided to pursue the president of the company. They gave him two options: be indicted on income tax fraud or tell them all he knows. The question to be answered was, who is receiving the bribes? The president of the company's name was Lester Matz. Matz, being ever so faithful to Agnew, gave him a call to inform him of the investigation and begged him to have it shut down. This was the first time Agnew was hearing of such an investigation. He knew in that moment that he might eventually be in deep waters. Matz claims to have started paying Spiro Agnew since he was Baltimore County executive, as well as when he was governor, all the way up until now when he visited Vice President Agnew in the White House to deliver a cash payment of $10,000 in January of 1969. On another occasion, Agnew had been receiving bribes from the Maryland State Highway Administration. The head of the administration had detailed records of the payoffs to Agnew while he was governor. Alan Green also had information to tell the prosecutors. Green claims to have paid Governor Agnew $2,000 cash 5 to 6 times a year. The payments continued after Agnew was vice president and would even go to the vice president's residence in Washington to meet. After learning of this information, George Ball schedules a meeting with Attorney General of the United States, Elliot Richardson. Richardson was appointed by President Nixon himself, so it was unsure of how the meeting would go. Would he protect the Nixon-Agnew administration, or would he be a faithful public official regardless of the interest? After Ball explained that the vice president had taken and may currently still be taking bribes, it was agreed. Such action is intolerable and should be investigated thoroughly. It wasn't until August 4, 1973, until the public found out about the investigation. The Wall Street Journal printed out a front-page story announcing that Vice President Agnew was under investigation. Spiro claimed that the media was doing a witch hunt and telling half-truths. To denounce his involvement in anything being brought against him, he held two press conferences. When President Nixon was informed about the investigation, he was visibly shaken and nearly speechless. Publicly, President Nixon was a supporter of Agnew. It wasn't until Agnew criticized the Department of Justice when Nixon could no longer support him. Nixon couldn't stand behind a man that attacked the government. There is plenty of irony there. Nixon expected Agnew to resign. Agnew himself had other plans. When Agnew met with Attorney General Elliot Richardson, he denied almost everything. Yet he admitted having accepted cash, claiming it was purely political contributions. Knowing time was of the essence, there was one question that needed to be answered. Could a vice president be indicted? A president could not, simply for the fact that the job could not be done without one's undivided attention. Therefore, saying a court case would spread the president's time too thin to focus on the duties of the country. On the other hand, the final answer from the Office of Legal Counsel says yes, a vice president can be indicted while in office. Why is that? According to the OLC, the principal responsibility of the vice president is to be ready to serve as president or acting president should the occasion arise. It simply would not jeopardize government entities shall the vice president not be present. Not satisfied with the OLC's answer, Agnew took himself to Capitol Hill, straight for the office of House Speaker Carl Albert. He handed Albert a 3-page letter asking Congress to investigate him. Agnew figured he had a better chance with the guys in Washington judging him and sentencing him, but Congress was not impressed. Ultimately and surprisingly, there was no investigation from Congress. After a long fight, Agnew threw in the towel. It was October 10, 1973, when Agnew appeared in federal court in Baltimore. He pleaded nolo contendere, no contest, to one felony charge, tax evasion for the year of 1967. This means that he does not admit guilt, but accepts conviction as if he had entered a guilty plea. At the same time he is in the courthouse, a letter is being sent to Henry Kissinger stating his resignation from office. Another letter was sent to President Nixon saying he is resigning for the best interest of the nation. Where was the best interest of the nation for him for the past decade? It seems to many, including myself, that all Agnew got was a slap on the wrist. He was fined a measly $10,000 and placed on unsupervised probation for 3 years. So basically, nothing. Not a single thing happened that would truly affect him. Many wonder where all the money went. The IRS began a net income investigation, but once Agnew pleaded guilty, the investigation stopped. That would not be the end for Agnew. After he resigned from office, he scurried to Ocean City in Maryland. Having found himself drowning in legal bills and expenses to live, he needed a loan. Who better to get a loan from than old Frank Sinatra? I am not joking. Sinatra and Agnew were good friends and had been since they met in 1972. Sinatra loaned him $200,000, $1.3 million in today's money. Having some stability, he attempted to be a lawyer again. Smartly enough, the Maryland Court of Appeals disbarred him, so that option was out. What was the next best thing for vice president turned felon to do? Write an extremely anti-Semitic book, of course. The Canfield decision was a book about a vice president that had troubled relationships with the president. While promoting the book on tour, Agnew commented on a character in the book who refers to Jewish people as a secret political clique, saying this was true in real life. A book written by Agnew in 1980 would lead him to more controversy. Go Quietly, or Else, talks about his time as vice president and the events leading to his resignation. This more than backfired when his former attorney, George White, would sue him for defamation. Although the lawsuit was settled once Agnew sent White a 2-page letter apologizing, things were not clear for the former vice president. A group of George Washington University law students filed a suit on behalf of the Maryland taxpayers against Spiro Agnew in April of 1981. Thanks to their relentless effort, Agnew was forced to pay back $147,000 for the bribes he had received throughout his years as an elected official, and $101,000 in interest, which accumulated at 6% a year. It was in 1983 when Agnew paid the state of Maryland back. A check of $268,000 from Agnew was given to the Maryland's treasurer. No, it wasn't jail time, but it was a victory knowing that the taxpayers were given what they were owed. Spiro Agnew, remaining bitter about his relationship with Richard Nixon, feeling he abandoned him in a time of need, declined any calls from him. In 1994, Julie Nixon, Richard's daughter, invited Agnew to her father's funeral. On the fence about attending the former president's funeral, he put his resentment aside and decided to go. It was 2 short years later, on September 17, 1996, when Spiro Agnew himself passed away due to leukemia. He passed away at the Atlantic General Hospital in Berlin, Maryland. The investigation and resignation of Spiro Agnew are not talked about quite as much as they should be. Had it not been for Watergate, Agnew's resignation may have been one of the biggest political scandals of the 20th century. His legacy needs to be talked about as a remembrance of the ugly that can sometimes pollute politics, so we as a nation can avoid any repeats of his heinous crimes. If you would like to hear more on the subject, there is an extremely informative podcast called Bagman by Rachel Maddow and Michael Yarvitz. You can also see George Baugh recall the investigation he led on C-SPAN. Any comments or questions can be emailed to thechroniclesoftimepodcast@gmail.com and any episode suggestions as well. I love hearing your all's thoughts and comments. Thank you so much for listening. This is Rachel Payton with the Chronicles of Time, and until next time.